Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn and Anne Ball. Later, Steve Ember will present a special Making of a Nation report on the Cold War. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Some machines can take something written in one language and give users the same or similar wording in another language. These machines are designed to do this kind of work quickly and without mistakes. Some of the devices are so small they can be carried around the world. The quality of translation software programs has greatly improved in recent years thanks to new, fast-developing technologies. This has led many people to start using machine translators. Some depend on the technology for day-to-day activities, while others use it in their job. But how will this affect language learning across the world? Will fewer people decide to take traditional language classes? Will human language teachers no longer be needed? One of the most widely used machine translation services is Google Translate. Google says the service completes billions of translation requests involving 103 languages each year. Google Translate can translate whole websites, text messages, and information inside programs on smartphones. It also can translate speech spoken into a device. Sundar Pichai is Google's chief executive officer. He told a recent launch event that the company has made important progress with machine translation in the past few years. Pichai said Google had earlier used a system that translated on what he called a phrase-by-phrase level. This system created speech that could usually be understood but did not sound natural. Pichai said Google is now excited to be moving on to a new model, one that provides better results. The new system is known as Neural Machine Translation. It uses large amounts of computer information to learn over time how to produce translations that sound more like real human language. Pichai said Google's own research has shown progress in this area. He added that the company's neuro-machine translation system is even approaching human-level translation. Google is developing the translation method along with other products using artificial intelligence technology. Other companies and organizations are also studying neural machine translation. It is closely related to a machine learning method known as deep learning. Deep learning involves putting large amounts of data into a computer for processing. The computer then uses an algorithm to learn how to recognize and organize different objects, including words and sentences. Philip Kuhn teaches at Johns Hopkins University in the American state of Maryland. He has studied machine translation for many years. He says all methods work in a similar way. Over time, the software program learns to translate from billions of language examples. Kuhn agrees that the quality of machine translation has improved a lot, but he says machines still have a long way to go to catch up with humans.
I would be very cautious about any claims about human level quality. There are just too many problems. Ultimately, to solve the machine translation problem, you have to solve all the problems in AI and understanding, and we're not close to that by any means.
Kuhn helped to create an open source machine translation system called Moses. Facebook, Amazon, and other big companies now use this service. He is also working on neural machine translation methods. Kuhn says people can now expect fast translation of websites, texts, and social media messages. But he does not think the wide availability and future improvements in software will lead people to stop studying languages. He gives the example of Europe, where borders are open and people travel often but speak different languages.
Things like automated translation, which makes it possible that everything gets translated into your native language, actually helps preserving the diversity of languages.
Marty Abbott agrees. She is the executive director of the American Council on the Teaching of Foreign Languages. Abbott says teachers can act as a bridge for students to learn about new cultures, something technology cannot provide. Abbott says many young people want to try to learn one or more foreign languages to connect with people around the world. Some might start out using Google Translate, but then decide they want to expand their learning and knowledge in the classroom. She added that technologies like machine translation are giving teachers many more tools to assist in teaching languages. But she said nothing will be able to replace the help and guidance provided by human teachers. Kuhn says machines will just keep getting better at translating in many different languages. They will also be able to communicate and react to other requests. But he added that getting the machines to think on their own in truly human-like ways is still a long way off. I'm Brian Lynn.
The number of giraffes has dropped by as much as 40% since the 1980s, says a new report on endangered species. The Red List is a study of threatened species by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. The group now considers the giraffe vulnerable to extinction for the first time. Earlier, it had a rating of least concern. The giraffe is the tallest animal on land. These beautiful creatures are one of the best-known species in Africa. They are known for their very long necks, long legs, and the brown and white patterns that cover their bodies. Craig Hilton Taylor is head of the Red List program. He says in 1985 there were between 152,000 and 163,000 giraffes. But now, he tells VOA, their numbers have fallen to about 98,000.
It is a huge tragedy. It's been a sort of a silent disappearance that we just hadn't really detected until now.
50 years ago, groups of giraffes usually had 20 to 30 animals in them. Now, observers are only seeing 6 animals in a group called a herd. The Red List experts have been gathering information about giraffes over the last 5 years. They counted the animals from airplanes, land vehicles, and on foot. They say that until now, the disappearance of the animals had not been observed closely. One reason could be because giraffes live in a wide area across Africa. What is causing this decrease? Hilton Taylor says, humans.
The reasons are all due to the impacts of people, whether it's people causing loss of the habitat for the species, hunting of the species for food or harvesting for medicinal purposes, or for timber.
He says pollution and the effects of climate change are just a few of the other problems affecting the species. Some people are moving into protected areas where giraffes and other animals live because of a lack of rain that affects food production. Sometimes the graceful plant-eating animals are killed for their meat. Also, civil wars and unrest in Africa make it more difficult to protect the animals. It is harder to do conservation work to protect the animals in danger in areas of armed conflict.
So, tackling the giraffe issue is not just purely about conservation of the species, it's also about dealing with governments, about political control, about people's rights and resources, access to resources. So it's quite a complex set of things you have to address.
Hilton Taylor says the fact the giraffe is now listed as vulnerable means that it has a high risk of going extinct in the wild unless we do something about it. But, he says, giraffes can be helped.
It's not too late. We can turn things around. We know in parts of Africa, giraffes are doing well. The population, some of the subpopulations are increasing in size, so we can see what's being done in those areas.
Some of the ideas that work include community involvement and tourism. Tourism, for example, provides jobs for local residents. He also says there needs to be a giraffe action plan put in place to observe and survey the animals across the continent of Africa. Hilton Taylor adds that finding answers to the problems people face, like drought linked to climate change, food shortages, and civil unrest, also will provide answers to help giraffes. The Red List is considered an important source of information about risks to both animals and plants. The program says 24,307 of the 85,604 species of animals and plants it studied were in danger of extinction. I'm Ann Ball.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell about the period known as the Cold War. The Cold War began after World War II. The main enemies were the United States and the Soviet Union. The Cold War got its name because both sides were afraid of fighting each other directly. In a hot war, nuclear weapons might destroy everything. So instead, both sides fought each other indirectly. They supported opposing sides in conflicts in different parts of the world. They also used words as weapons. They threatened and denounced each other, or they tried to make each other look foolish. Over the years, leaders on both sides changed, yet the Cold War continued. It was the major force in world politics for most of the second half of the 20th century. The Cold War world was separated into three groups. The United States led the West. This group included countries with democratic political systems. The Soviet Union led the East. This group included countries with communist political systems. The non-aligned group included countries that did not want to be tied to either the West or the East. Harry Truman was the first American president to fight the Cold War. He used several policies. One was the Truman Doctrine. This was a plan to give money and military aid to countries threatened by communism. The Truman Doctrine effectively stopped communists from taking control of Greece and Turkey. Another policy was the Marshall Plan. This strengthened the economies and governments of countries in Western Europe. A major event in the Cold War was the Berlin Airlift. After World War II, the United States and its allies divided Germany. Berlin was a part of communist East Germany. The city was divided into East and West. In June 1948, Soviet-led forces blocked all roads and railways leading to the western part of Berlin. President Truman quickly ordered military airplanes to fly coal, food, and medicine to the city. The planes kept coming, sometimes landing every few minutes for more than a year. The United States received help from Britain and France. Together, they provided almost 2.5 million tons of supplies on about 280,000 flights. The United States also led the formation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in 1949. NATO was a joint military group. Its purpose was to defend against Soviet forces in Europe. The Soviet Union and its East European allies formed their own joint military group, the Warsaw Pact, 6 years later. In 1953, Soviet leader Joseph Stalin died. His death gave the new American president, Dwight Eisenhower, a chance to deal with new Soviet leaders. In July 1955, Eisenhower and Nikolai Bulganin met in Geneva, Switzerland. The leaders of Britain and France also attended. Eisenhower proposed that the Americans and Soviets agree to let their military bases be inspected by air by the other side. The Soviets later rejected the proposal. Yet, the meeting in Geneva was not considered a failure. After all, the leaders of the world's most powerful nations had shaken hands. Cold War tensions increased, then eased, then increased again over the years. The changes came as both sides attempted to influence political and economic developments around the world. For example, the Soviet Union provided military, economic, and technical aid to communist governments in Asia. The United States then helped 8 Asian nations fight communism by establishing the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, known as CETO. In the 1950s, the United States began sending military advisors to help South Vietnam defend itself against communist North Vietnam. That aid would later expand into a long and bloody period of American involvement in Vietnam. The Cold War also affected the Middle East. In the 1950s, both East and West offered aid to Egypt to build the Aswan High Dam on the Nile River. The West canceled its offer, however, after Egypt bought weapons from the communist government in Czechoslovakia. Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser then seized control of the company that operated the Suez Canal. A few months later, Israel invaded Egypt. France and Britain joined the invasion. For once, the United States and the Soviet Union agreed on a major issue. Both supported a United Nations resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire. The Suez Crisis was a political victory for the Soviets. When the Soviet Union supported Egypt, it gained new friends in the Arab world. In 1959, Cold War tensions eased a little. The new Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, visited Dwight Eisenhower in the United States. The meeting was very friendly. But the next year, relations got worse again. An American U-2 reconnaissance airplane was shot down over the Soviet Union. The plane and its pilot, Francis Gary Powers, were captured. Eisenhower admitted that such planes had been spying on the Soviets for years. In a speech at the United Nations, Khrushchev got so angry that he took off his shoe and beat it on a table. John F. Kennedy followed Eisenhower as president in 1961. During his early days in office, Cuban exiles invaded Cuba. It came to be known as the Bay of Pigs invasion. The forces wanted to oust the communist government of Fidel Castro. America's Central Intelligence Agency had provided training for the exiles. But the United States failed to send military planes to protect them during the invasion. As a result, almost all were killed or taken prisoner by Cuban forces trained and supported by the Soviet Union and Soviet allied nations. At the same time in Europe, tens of thousands of East Germans had been fleeing to the West. East Germany's government decided to stop them. It built a wall separating the eastern and western parts of the city of Berlin. Guards shot at anyone who tried to flee by climbing over. During Kennedy's second year in office, American intelligence reports discovered Soviet missiles in Cuba.
This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, Unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
The Soviet Union denied the missiles were there. Yet American photographs taken from high in the air proved they were. America's ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson.
Let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation, yes or no?
Mr. Stevenson, would you continue your statement, please? You will receive the answer in the due course. Do not worry.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision. And I'm also prepared to present the evidence in this room.
The Cuban Missile Crisis easily could have resulted in a nuclear war. Americans felt especially threatened with those missiles just 150 kilometers from the Florida coast. But the crisis ended after a week. Khrushchev agreed to remove the missiles if the United States agreed not to interfere in Cuba. Some progress was made in easing Cold War tensions when Kennedy was president. In 1963, the two sides reached a major arms control agreement. They agreed to ban tests of nuclear weapons above ground, underwater, and in space. They also established a direct telephone link between the White House and the Kremlin. Relations between East and West also improved when Richard Nixon was president. He and Leonid Brezhnev met several times. They reached several arms control agreements. One reduced the number of missiles used to shoot down enemy nuclear weapons. It also banned the testing and deployment of long-distance missiles for 5 years. A major change in the Cold War would take place in 1985 when Mikhail Gorbachev became leader of the Soviet Union. He met 4 times with President Ronald Reagan. Gorbachev withdrew Soviet forces from Afghanistan, and he signed an agreement with the United States to destroy all middle-distance and short-distance nuclear missiles. By 1989, there was widespread unrest in Eastern Europe. Gorbachev did not intervene as one Eastern European country after another cut its ties with the Soviet Union. The Berlin Wall, the major symbol of communist oppression, was torn down in November of that year. In less than a year, East and West Germany became one nation again. A few months after that, Warsaw Pact countries officially ended the alliance. The Cold War was over. The Cold War years were also the time of the space race, when the United States and the Soviet Union competed in space exploration. That will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.